You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the US President uses his first speech at the UN General Assembly to call for consensus.
We've ended 20 years of conflict in Afghanistan. And as we close this period of relentless war, we're opening a new era of relentless diplomacy.
Also coming up, we ask what's left of a democratic voice in Hong Kong as only one opposition member is left standing in a governing committee of 1,500. We'll also hear the latest instalment of our series looking at Germany's election. Today, a look at the country's vital relationship with China.
Gone are the days when German businesses came gushing into the country in search of lucrative opportunities. In are the days of questioning whether such close economic ties are really a good thing.
Plus why Sweden's parents could be in for an extra week off work. And we look at the latest newspapers in the Middle East and the headlines from the podcasting world as well. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Joe Biden has played down hopes of a direct trade deal between the US and the UK following talks with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at the White House. China is to stop funding coal projects overseas, ending a major source of pollution. And more than 6,000 people have now been evacuated from areas surrounding an erupting volcano on La Palma in the Spanish Canary Islands. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, speeches at the UN General Assembly have been dominated by two now regular subjects, COVID and climate change. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a dramatic and urgent warning in his opening address. He spoke of an increasingly divided world, and he called for action in the face of the greatest cascade of crises in our lifetimes. I'm here, he said, to sound the alarm. The world must wake up. Well, making his maiden appearance at the General Assembly in New York was US President Joe Biden, who pointed out that our security, our prosperity and our very freedoms are interconnected, in my view, as never before.
We've ended 20 years of conflict in Afghanistan. And as we close this period of relentless war, we're opening a new era of relentless diplomacy, of using the power of our development aid to invest in new ways of lifting people up around the world, of renewing and defending democracy.
Our news editor Chris Chermak has more on a speech that urged unity among allies.
Joe Biden's speech before the UN General Assembly in New York yesterday was intended to signal a pivot in approach. Yes, the US exit from Afghanistan may have been messy, but after 20 years of war, that decision was about closing a necessary chapter and turning the page. By contrast, Joe Biden stressed that he was intent on opening a new chapter and reopening the United States to the world. From climate change to the pandemic, the world stood at an inflection point, he said, and many of its challenges could only be solved if countries worked together. As if to emphasize the point, Joe Biden's promise of more diplomatic engagement came as the U.S. this week said it would lift travel restrictions from November on foreigners entering the country, restrictions that had been in place since the start of the pandemic. But his promise of working more closely with allies rang more hollow, coming in the middle of a major diplomatic spat with France over the US and UK taking over a submarine contract with Australia. For many allies of the US, Joe Biden still needs to show that his actions will match the promises of his first in-person speech before the United Nations.
That was our news editor Chris Chermak there on US President Joe Biden's maiden speech at the UN General Assembly. One unlikely to be paying too much attention to President Biden's words was Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro. Unvaccinated against COVID and defiant, Mr. Bolsonaro was pushed back hard against his critics, as Lucinda Elliott now reports.
As per tradition, Brazil's leader opens the General Assembly. This decision isn't actually based on the South American nation standing internationally, but dates back to the mid-1950s, when no other country's head of state was willing to do so. That position today is considered a coveted slot that can help set the tone of the week for everyone. Trouble is, President Bolsonaro wasn't really looking to a global audience. His opening speech was directed at Brazilian voters, ahead of a presidential vote next year, with talk of family values, unemployment, the hostile Brazilian media, and pushing disproven COVID treatments. Many delegates who don't follow local politics for those 12 minutes would have been baffled by what he was going on about. There was a nod to the environment, Brazil being home to the Amazon rainforest, considered one of the most important buffers against climate change. Bolsonaro's tone was on the defensive, presenting a picture of his government working hard on environmental legislation, when there's plenty of evidence of serious setbacks and negligence under his watch. He'll just return home pleased that he was allowed into the hall at all, Bolsonaro being the only leader who claims not to be vaccinated.
That was Lucinda Elliott there on Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro setting a baffling tone at the start of the General Assembly. Another singular voice was that of the Turkish President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Our Middle East commentator Ruth Michelson has more.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey took the stand at the UN General Assembly to remind the world of its collective responsibility. Erdogan listed the troubles that the world is facing, starting with the COVID-19 pandemic. The pandemic, he said, was a solidarity test that the world failed miserably. He then moved on to advances in medical science and the benefits of vaccines, with a reminder that the first WHO-approved vaccine came from two Turkish scientists based in Germany. Still, he said, in the near future, Turkey plans to offer its own homemade vaccine, Turkovac. Erdogan then conducted a tour of Turkey's international interests. The international community cannot allow the conflict in Syria to continue for another 10 years, he said, urging a political solution. In Afghanistan, he said, problems can't be solved by imposing solutions that don't account for the realities on the ground and the social fabric. If you think this is a swipe at the United States, you are probably right. He added that when one country acts unilaterally, all of humanity pays the bill. On the question of Cyprus, Erdogan used his speech to demand the international community look at the Turkish Cypriots as co-owners of the island and listen to their interests. Finally, he addressed the many effects of climate change. You cannot manufacture the solutions to climate change in a lab, he said. Fairness and global responsibility were the prevailing themes. A fairer world is possible despite difficulties we face, he said, concluding with a message to the delegates. May you all remain in good health. For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Ruth Michelson.
Oh, we'll be hearing more from Ruth a little later in today's programme when she looks at today's Middle Eastern papers. But first, to get a broader overview of the UN General Assembly, I'm joined by Natalie Samarasinghe, who's CEO of the United Nations Association here in the United Kingdom. Good morning, Natalie.
Hello, Emma.
Before we dive into what each respective leader had to say and whether that call for unity was actually heeded, let's examine a little bit what the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres's warning entails. And these were incredibly strong words, weren't they? Calling for action in the face of the greatest cascade of crises in our lifetimes. He didn't pull punches, did he?
No, he didn't. And I think it was very unusual in terms of his speech because he was so forthright. He gave, I think, quite frankly, a frightening assessment of the state of the world. He covered conflict hotspots, the climate emergency, the breakdown in trust. That was a key theme of the speech. And he talked about these big divides that we need to bridge: peace, climate, wealth, gender, digital, and generational. So inequality, I think, was the sort of current running through his speech. He threw in quite a few zingers, I thought, looking at, you know, this stark image of vaccines being discarded in bins because they're past their sell-by dates, whilst 90% of Africans are still waiting for their first dose. But I think there was actually quite a lot of hope in there as well. This wasn't a sort of airy-fairy speech with, you know, lots of hand-wringing. It was dripping with policy recommendations drawn from his new report. So I think the tone was really about shifting us from crisis mode onto action.
And this was arguably the same tone that Joe Biden used when he was talking about, you know, a new pivot in approach, as Chris Chermak just mentioned earlier on, making the United States more open. But many now think that he's a man that says one thing, but indeed it's a different matter.
I think the speech, you know, as a speech was very good. It was the balancing act between, you know, coming to the General Assembly on the back of the AUKUS deal, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the way the US sort of blocked discussion in the Security Council in the summer. You know, I think he would have had a hero's welcome had he come to the General Assembly, you know, 6 months ago. I think everyone would have just been relieved to hear a coherent, fluent speech by a US president. But I think he managed to strike that balance between reaching the domestic audience, you know, addressing China without actually ever mentioning China, although interesting that Zhang got a mention in there. But, you know, he tried very hard to back his words up by concrete action. So announcing something on climate finance, something on COVAX, you know, on vaccines. Those are the two core issues that everyone is going to be listening on, you know, climate and COVID. And I think he tried to back up his words there. I thought it was very interesting that the Chinese statement also got into that territory, announcing, you know, a big pivot in their strategy in terms of not funding coal plants overseas, also announcing lots of, you know, cash for COVAX and vaccines. So you can sort of see how the fault lines are being created by those two countries around those issues.
And we have fault lines, which arguably we should not really have, given the fact that, let's look at the COVID pandemic. It should, in theory, have been something that brought us together as a human race. And in actual fact, if we just listen to the assessment of a moment ago of Joe Biden's speech, Jair Bolsonaro's speech and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's speech, we have one man saying, well, let's all come together, another man not even being vaccinated, and someone else, actually, we're going to make our own vaccine, Turcovac. This is not what should have happened, is it?
No, I mean, precisely. Those two issues really demonstrate the value of global cooperation, the need to do it. I mean, this is not just about a sort of moral imperative. This is very much in our self-interest to come together. That's what the Secretary General, I think, was trying to say. And that's why the UN matters so much. But I think, you know, if you were an alien probably listening to the speeches yesterday, not aware of some of the domestic, you know, concerns, I think apart from Bolsonaro's bizarre sort of soliloquy on contracts, you would have thought, you know, this is a group of world leaders who take these two issues quite seriously. But if you listened more carefully, you saw, again, it's about the divide. It's about burden sharing. So actually something that, you know, Erdogan said, which will have resonated with lots of other states, is this, you know, picture of Turkey taking in 4 million Syrians and richer countries that were involved in the fallout from, you know, Syria, Afghanistan, etc., not taking in refugees. This is about burden sharing. This is about who is actually bearing the brunt, whether that's conflict, COVID or climate, and who is willing to step up to the plate.
Talking about climate change, how much is this being seen as arguably a dress rehearsal for COP26 in Glasgow next month, when there will be the opportunity to talk, but there will be a much more pressing need for action and decisions to be made?
I mean, I think the UN Secretary General and the UK will hope that they can use not, you know, as much the formal, but probably the informal spaces at the General Assembly to really make some progress. I think there's just 6 weeks or so to go now ahead of COP26. We saw a little bit of that in the speeches yesterday. We had, you know, a commitment actually by Erdogan to ratify the Paris deal. Even Bolsonaro talked a bit about environmental issues. So I think the sense of urgency is there. It's whether those commitments, which, you know, quite frankly, we have heard before, we will give more money to, you know, the climate financing facility and so on, whether they can actually be translated into concrete steps in time to make Glasgow seem like it's had an outcome and moved us forward. That is a huge challenge. I'm not sure we'll have any big breakthroughs this week, but hopefully behind the scenes, things are bubbling away.
How much is the General Assembly a cue for a wider examination on the future of the organisation, of the UN itself? A desire and a need, perhaps, to update it for the future?
I think whenever the UN General Assembly opens its session in September, people say, you know, is the UN still relevant? Does it still matter? I think we've moved beyond those questions now because of the challenges we face. It's pretty obvious we need an institution like that. Then the question is, how do you make it fit for purpose? And, you know, as much as last year was, you know, a General Assembly happening virtually for the first time amidst a sort of sense of crisis, this time the narrative really is about, I think, moving forward, looking to the future. So the Secretary General's speech was all about how do we future-proof the organization? How do we take account of future generations? How do we make the UN more inclusive and networked? This is a huge priority for, you know, for us and others in civil society. And I think it was an interesting, you know, speech that he made because it sort of moves the UN from maybe trying to always be front and center on crises to becoming more of a platform and a resource for member states, providing data, foresight, analysis, you know, accurate information, which we know is so crucial right now. And really saying we recognize that is the UN's role going forward. We can step up in certain areas, but in others, it is down to governments to lead in partnership with all of society. I think that's quite a big break actually in messaging and quite an interesting one to watch.
Natalie Samarasinghe there. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. And you're back with The Globalist on Monocle 24. Over the past week, thousands of migrants, mostly fleeing Haiti, have been gathering at the US border with Mexico. The southern Texan town of Del Rio has struggled to manage as crowds have steadily flowed in its direction, numbering up to 14,000. Last weekend, however, the US said it would remove them, flying migrants back to Haiti and other countries, with the Biden administration already buckling under record migration. Well, I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Sabatini, who's senior fellow for Latin America at Chatham House in London. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Emma.
So just explain to us what the situation looks like at the US-Mexico border.
Well, visually, it's quite tragic and difficult to look at. There are about 14,000 Haitian undocumented immigrants clustered under a bridge overpass in Texas. You know, just lines of porta potties and all in these makeshift tents. There are a lot of them without food. They're actually bringing food, many of them across the border, across the river from Mexico. Many of them are families. It is really just a pretty grim situation. And then on top of that, you have these images that have come out of U.S. border agents trying to deter immigrants from crossing, but also trying to round them up on horses. The agents are on horses. And it's just an awful image that really looks just really abusive. It's unfortunate. And so it is really right now, unfortunately, one of the main news items being covered in the United States.
Why is it happening right now?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, many of these that are trying to cross now actually fled long ago after the 2010 Haiti earthquake that killed over 200,000 people. And many of them had flown and gone to Ecuador, Brazil, in places in South America where they don't need visas. But now many of them are leaving and trying to enter the United States because there's a sense that Biden's more liberal immigration policies may afford them an opportunity to be able to get asylum status because also of the conditions in Haiti right now. The president was assassinated in June. There was another earthquake there as well, a 7.2 scale earthquake. And so the situation is quite dire in Haiti. And so the hope was that they could apply for asylum once in the United States, but that apparently isn't happening.
One thing that has been leading to a lot of criticism is the mechanism that the Biden administration is using to remove these migrants. He's using a policy known as Title 42, which was something that came from the Trump era and is not to do with the removal of migrants per se, is it?
That's exactly right. He's removing them under claims of public health risks. This is from COVID-19. There's no reason to believe these are a public health risk. It could be contained, but there, you know, many of the policies, unfortunately, the Trump administration, including some of the stay-in-place asylum policies that had not just Haitians, but also Central Americans and Mexicans and others waiting inside Mexico to apply for U.S. asylum, are being continued under the Biden policy. And as you mentioned earlier in the lead-in, Biden is really being hit quite hard by an immigration crisis. Well, crisis was probably, according to some, it's simply, the flow had been bottled up under the Trump administration. But according just this year alone, since his swearing in, more than 200,000 people have been detained trying to cross the border illegally into Texas. So you're looking at a huge inflow right now. And the Haiti situation is simply one that is unfortunately much easier to identify because they're crossing at one single point and much easier to argue that they should be returned.
And it is also leading to serious questions being raised about Biden and his migration policy, given the fact that when he came into office, which is less than a year ago, he was saying that the US was a more tolerant and welcoming place.
Well, right now, you're right. The immigration debate in the United States is just poisonous. And I don't know how it's going to get any better, quite frankly. The US Senate just stripped out of the budget bill a plan bill by the White House to basically legalize the undocumented immigrants that are living in the United States and for broader immigration reform. So that's not going to happen anytime quickly. And absent that, what you're going to get are these really patchwork, often abusive policies at the border targeting individuals and that are deeply inhumane. I mean, they're holding people in Texas, also bottled up in Mexico, in really subhuman conditions. These camps are quite squalid. Their access to food is a problem. They still are separating the children, not at the rate they were before, from their families when they're processing some of these cases. And so it's a really difficult situation. And on top of it, of course, you have the COVID-19 crisis. Not a reason to return people to Haiti, as this administration, unfortunately, is using it. But it is a problem for people that are in these confined, closed spaces.
How much pushback is there from not just the Republicans, but also from within the Democrats as well? I mean, there has been a letter written, hasn't there, to the Biden administration from 50 Democratic lawmakers who don't actually raise the more general issue about the Biden administration's treatment of migrants and whether it is going in a more human and welcoming direction or the exact opposite. But it is raising the specific issues that you raised earlier. The fact is that the Haitian government is unstable. It will take an awfully long time for Haiti to stabilize, if ever, in the next few years. So they're using all the tactics they can, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And there's also, this is about politics, too. I mean, there are motives about just, concerns for human beings and their treatment of them. But there's a large Haitian constituency in the United States in places like Florida and New York. And a lot of those congresspeople and senators are from those states. And they're an important lobby group. But they're raising legitimate issues. Haiti is really in dire straits right now. It has effectively no government, no plan. It seems to elect a new government. It's still recovering not just from the earthquake that happened earlier this year, but still from the 2010 earthquake. It is deeply riven by politics and crime and violence. And a lot of these people, as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, Emma, they had left Haiti earlier after the 2010 earthquake. So many of them haven't lived in Haiti for years now. And so they're returning to a place that's simply not home.
So where does this now lead if the Biden administration is going to take this much tougher line on migration than many expected?
I think it's going to be forced to reconsider. You've already seen Vice President Kamala Harris has expressed her concern about the treatment of the immigrants. The head of Homeland Security, which oversees U.S. immigration policy, has said he's going to review this. Earlier in this year, in June, the U.S. extended temporary protected status for Haitians, which means that Haitians who are already living in the United States without sort of formal authority were allowed to remain. I suspect, given the optics of this right now and the politics, I think the Biden administration is going to try to put its best foot forward, and try to find some way to more routinely integrate and address the situation without, forcing them onto planes. And some of them had to be forced on the planes, by the way, in handcuffs, another horrible image, and find a way to integrate them into Haiti, into the United States, while also trying to stop this current flow, because it is, there are allegedly thousands more trying to cross the border. And I heard yesterday there are 20,000 Haitian immigrants that are already making their way from Ecuador towards the United States. So this is not going to end anytime soon. But at the same time, clearly the Biden administration has to show a better face in its treatment of human beings and Haitians.
Dr. Christopher Sabatini, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's programme, we explored Germany's fast-changing relationship with its biggest trading partner, China.
Gone are the days when German businesses came gushing into the country in search of lucrative opportunities. In are the days of questioning whether such close economic ties are really a good thing. Even the party of Chancellor Angela Merkel, who at the start of this year was still trumpeting a now-stalled EU investment treaty with China, recognises that the relationship needs to become a little less close.
That's all coming up on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
7:25 here in London now. The scope of democracy in Hong Kong seemed to narrow even further this weekend as the city's elite sector selected a powerful committee to choose nearly half the legislature. There was a change in the rules from before, however, with a new patriots-only system imposed by Beijing. As a result, out of the 1,500-strong committee, there now remains only one person who's a member of the opposition. Well, Steve Tsang is the director of the China Institute at SOAS, the University of London, and a regular voice here. Good morning. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Steve.
Good morning, Emma.
Just tell us, before we get to the election this weekend, just tell us about this committee and its influence, please.
Well, the committee of 1,500 is entirely responsible for electing or selecting the chief executive of Hong Kong. And this is its main function. And controlling this committee means you basically control who will be the chief executive of Hong Kong.
And as a result, this weekend's elections or selections change what in terms of its makeup? A dramatic shift, I think it can be said.
It is a dramatic shift. Now, even before the recent changes this week, the committee was already having a majority of people who would be seen as establishment or pro-Beijing characters, and therefore they were really never going to be able to elect somebody that Beijing did not approve of at all. But what they have changed is to basically make Hong Kong, if you like, a patriotic Chinese city with global reach, rather than, as Hong Kong liked to call it previously, Asia's global city.
And how will this be felt in Hong Kong itself?
I think people in Hong Kong knew this would be coming. So I think people in Hong Kong accepted that there is really not a lot they could do about it. And most people in Hong Kong who understand Chinese politics also understand the Chinese Communist Party's ways to democracy, which is that the Communist Party welcome full direct elections of all sorts, provided the results were pre-approved by the Communist Party and known to it beforehand.
We now have a situation, therefore, that Hong Kong's direction is very much towards Beijing and vice versa. For those within Hong Kong, you have to deal with the domestic consequences. But for those outside Hong Kong wanting to deal with the city, how does such a strong committee and strong direction now influence the way that people do business with them? I mean, it is so stark now, isn't it?
Well, it is very stark. But I think the impact on the business environment in Hong Kong is actually going to be a lot less than one would expect for the kind of changes under Foley in Hong Kong. The reason is that for the relatively small number of outsiders, Westerners in Hong Kong who found the changes unacceptable, they would be trying to relocate outside of Hong Kong. But the overwhelming majority of them in Hong Kong are focused on the business situation. And because of the wider tension between China and the United States and the change in policy to make sure that Chinese companies are not being floated in New York in particular, and even less in London, and a bit less in London, Hong Kong is going to get a lot more Chinese companies being floated in the stock market. So the immediate economic impact would be smaller. The business community will continue to be able to operate in Hong Kong, but in a changed way.
And the personal consequences for Carrie Lam, does this secure her in power for the foreseeable future now?
I don't think we know that as yet. It will depend on what Beijing really wants of her. She has demonstrated herself to be completely loyal and subservient to Beijing, but she has not demonstrated to Beijing that she has been a very efficient and capable chief executive of Hong Kong. So I think Beijing probably hasn't made up its mind fully whether Carrie Lam will be given a second term. A lot will depend on whether they can find somebody else whom they will see as much more effective than Carrie Lam would be.
Steve Tsang, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is 7:30 here in London. A quick look now at the headlines. Joe Biden has played down hopes of a direct trade deal between the US and the UK. The US president held talks with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at the White House, with Downing Street hoping that a deal with the US alone is possible. It's now understood that London could join an existing North American trade agreement. China is to stop funding coal projects overseas, ending a major source of pollution. President Xi Jinping made the announcement in a pre-recorded speech to the UN General Assembly. President Xi also promised to step up support for other developing countries in developing green and low-carbon energy. France's President Emmanuel Macron and the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi have pledged to act jointly in the Indo-Pacific region. It follows a row with Australia, the US and the UK over a cancelled submarine contract. And more than 6,000 people have now been evacuated from areas surrounding an erupting volcano on La Palma in the Spanish Canary Islands. The evacuation of El Paso was ordered after lava started spewing from a new crack in the Cumbre Vieja volcano. And those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Germany's federal elections to replace Angela Merkel take place this Sunday, and they are looking like quite a nail-biter. So for the final part of our series looking at the future of Germany's role in the world, our news editor Chris Chermak explores Germany's fast-changing relationship with its biggest trading partner and increasingly anti-democratic rival, China.
Of all the foreign policy topics that I've spoken to German lawmakers about for this election series, China was the one that often seemed to generate the most passion and the most hand-wringing. Pretty much everyone agrees that Germany's once close economic relationship with China has to change.
The China investment deal, or Nord Stream 2, to mention that again, that has been Germany first approach and not a Europe first or Europe together approach. I think that should change.
It's about Europe standing up against or in a concert with the other big forces in the world, so the US, Russia, China. So what are our European values and what do we stand for?
It's legitimate, therefore, to, you know, on a timeline, define a certain time frame within which we should reduce our China risk.
When we are honest, we see everywhere that economic interest is the first value the European Union and Germany is fighting for.
In the end, it's a possible cooperation partner on issues like climate change. China is an economic competitor, but China is also a systemic rival.
Gone are the days when German businesses came gushing into the country in search of lucrative opportunities. In are the days of questioning whether such close economic ties are really a good thing. Even the party of Chancellor Angela Merkel, who at the start of this year was still trumpeting a now-stalled EU investment treaty with China, recognizes that the relationship needs to become, well, a little less close.
The communist leadership in Beijing has totally different views than we do when it comes to democracy, the rule of law, and media freedom, and human rights.
This is David McAllister, a senior lawmaker of Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats.
I would always follow the free English seas in dealing with China, cooperate where possible, compete where needed, and confront and contain where necessary. So the how to deal with China will be the big foreign policy challenge in the next years and decades. And we Germans follow a China policy where we are pragmatic on the one hand, but our pragmatism is always based on firm values and principles.
Of course, this brand of principled pragmatism, as McAllister describes it, is easier said than done. China was Germany's most important individual trading partner in 2020 for the fifth consecutive year, with 212.9 billion euros in goods traded between them. And since Germany's own soft power is in many ways tied to its powerhouse economy, pulling the plug on that relationship is, well, doubly tough.
It is difficult, of course, because we cannot cut off countries.
This is Katharina Bali, senior European lawmaker of Germany's Social Democrats.
We are in a globalized world. We are in a digitalized world. So it all is becoming more and more one. But of course, you have to take a stand when it comes to fundamental rights and what's going on in China with the Uyghurs. What is going on in Russia with Navalny and others? That is something that we cannot be silent about. And I do think that there are cases where you have to bring up sanctions.
As ever, when it comes to German foreign policy, Katharina Bali and others stress that it's important for the European Union to act as one, rather than for Germany to act unilaterally, when it comes to things like imposing sanctions on China. And yet the subject of sanctions is not necessarily something that everyone in Germany agrees on.
I'm not on the opinion that sanctions mechanism are the right way to solve conflicts or problems.
This is Özlem Demirel of the Left Party. She says that Germany and the European Union have essentially let economic interests dictate their sanctions policy for far too long.
Also, in the case of sanctions, the politics and the reality of European Union and Germany is not honestly, because it's not linked to human rights, it's not linked to democratic questions, it's more linked, for example, to own interests.
Reinhard Budikofer, a senior foreign policy spokesman for the Greens, argues that Germany not only overexposed itself on China, but has allowed China to split Europe apart under its nose.
Just sitting on the sidelines and criticizing what China does and forgetting that we facilitated this opening for them by not being better partners to these needs ourselves. That would be stupid.
Butikofer notes that Beijing's investments in Europe, mostly through its Belt and Road Initiative, has led to a number of Eastern European and Balkan nations becoming overly indebted to China as a result. So, rather than focusing on sanctions, at least part of the answer is that Europe should invest more in developing countries to counter China's influence.
I recall a conversation with the Indonesian finance minister a couple of years ago in which she was asked what she thought of the Belt and Road Initiative. And her answer was, well, give me an alternative and I'll tell you what I think about it. We're only now beginning to build that alternative in reality.
While European politicians get busy redirecting investment, there is also a role for the German private sector. Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, senior lawmaker with the pro-business Free Democrats, points to German car makers who have gone headlong into China in the past decade to now lead the way out.
Volkswagen sells not 10, not 20, not 30% of its vehicles in China, but 40%. That is one egg in one basket that I think is clearly a risk exposure that goes way beyond what is reasonable.
He points to the Federation of German Industries, a lobby group, which last year called on its members to diversify and warned of significant risks to German businesses from the increasing strategic rivalry between the US and China. So, whatever happens in Germany's federal election at the end of this week, expect the next Berlin government to get tougher on China and to quietly prod Germany's businesses to do the same. For Monocle, I'm Chris Chermak.
Just coming up to 7:40 here in London, let's have a look at today's newspapers. Joining me is the Istanbul-based journalist Ruth Michelson for a look at what's happening in the Middle East. Hello, Ruth.
Good morning, Emma.
Let us look at what's happening in Sudan first and how it's being covered.
Absolutely. So Sudan is recovering from what the authorities have said was an attempted coup that took place yesterday morning. Just to give you an idea of how dramatic the scenes were briefly, the New York Times talks about tanks rolling down Khartoum, blocking the area between Khartoum and nearby Omdurman, when figures close to former President Omar al-Bashir tried to do a sort of classical coup move, if you like, and seize control of the state radio, and they were prevented from doing so. So we see in the New York Times that the current president, Abdullah Hamdok, is quoted as saying that this was an orchestrated coup by factions inside and outside the armed forces. This is an extension of the attempts by remnants of the former regime to abort the civilian democratic transition.
We have the New York Times is pulls no punches, given the fact that this is something that many people had expected would happen, because the transitional government has been in power since, what, 2019, when the former leader Bashir was overthrown by a military takeover. And people are now saying that this will not stop until the military is under full civilian power.
That is true. I mean, I think we should also point out that Omar al-Bashir was overthrown after enormous protests as well, but that there are remnants within the Sudanese security services that have loyalty to the former president and who are also particularly angry that the current Sudanese authorities are thinking of handing him over to the International Criminal Court, or have said that they will. So we see, for example, in Al Jazeera, that the current Minister of Information, Hamzat Balul, is saying that, you know, everything is now under control, that this was a coup, attempted coup by military officers, and that they have arrested the leaders of the failed plot. They said that this was civilians belonging to the defunct regime, and they said that they have arrested 11 officers. CNN have slightly more. They said that 40 people were arrested.
Do we know where this is going to go next?
Extremely good question. I mean, it sounds like the Sudanese authorities, based on what we're seeing in the press, are trying to stress that everything is under control and that actually within hours, calm reigned on the streets of Khartoum. We certainly see that in Reuters. There's also a military official, Abdullah Behan, who mentions that we want to take this country and hand it over to the public will to free and fair elections. Now, obviously, that coming from a military official isn't always reassuring, but there are people in Sudan looking to the transitional government headed by Abdullah Hamdok to make those free and fair elections happen as scheduled in a couple of years' time.
Let's move on to Afghanistan, as the Taliban is now absolutely firmly taking control of the country, and a huge number of stories are emerging about the role of women, or rather the lack of roles for women that there is in the Taliban's plans.
Absolutely. So we're seeing a lot of reporting about the Taliban's most recent decision around female education, specifically girls, secondary school age girls. So earlier this week, the Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, said that the Taliban were finalizing things and that girls in secondary school will return to the classroom as soon as possible. But we've already seen that boys are back in school. This is no issue. The issue is that we're seeing that girls of teenage years and above aren't returning to educational institutions, including, we see mention of this in the Wall Street Journal, who've covered this issue as well, mentioning that most female students at university, although they are technically allowed to go, they say that they're staying home out of fear, which is more than understandable.
Yeah, I mean, the Wall Street Journal has an amazing profile of a teacher who says, a female teacher who says the Taliban ordered her school to separate the students by gender. That, some are suggesting, is the least worst possibility, if that's possible to happen.
Well, it seems like part of the issue is that there's a lack of clarity surrounding what will happen. And the Taliban know that they're famous for preventing girls' education during their previous time in power, and that this time around they're trying to show a different face and saying, oh, no, girls are allowed to go to school. We just haven't made the rules around it yet. But what we are seeing, for example, there's some coverage of this in Axios and also in Al Jazeera, is that, so for example, Axios mentioned that the Taliban have rebranded the Afghan Women's Ministry as the Ministries of Prayer, Guidance, and Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. Al Jazeera also mentions that when cabinet ministers were named, of course, it's an all-male cabinet lineup.
Let's move on to a final story, a story of astonishing escape from prison with not the ending that the escapees wish to have.
That is correct. The last two of a group of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped from an Israeli prison called Gilboa Prison a couple of weeks ago were captured, and we're seeing reactions within the media to how Israelis and Palestinians alike have reacted to the fact that all six of them are now back in Israeli custody. The New York Times mentions that, for example, around 5,000 Palestinians are incarcerated in Israeli prisons. And so they say, to many Palestinians, their fate is synonymous with the daily experience of the occupation, as many people know someone who is either a prisoner of the Israeli security forces or has been one. And then at the same time, Israeli news coverage of the jailbreak has really focused on the security dangers posed by the fugitives and the screw-ups, basically, that allowed the six prisoners to dig their way out of prison using just spoons.
It is astonishing that you do have this. You've got to admire them, haven't you, slightly, for their attempt?
I mean, it is an absolutely, you know, movie-worthy story. There's some incredible coverage of this in the Washington Post. So they mention that some of the, for example, some of the flaws that led to these men being able to break out using spoons, again, getting into the plumbing system through their cell, was that the prison's architectural firm had posted blueprints of the prison facility online, and they were able to use this to figure out how to get out.
Wonderful. Ruth Michelson, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:47 here in London. It's time now to find out what's happening in the world of podcasts with James Cridland, editor of Pod News. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Emma. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to have you on the programme. Let's begin with this story that Virgin Atlantic have chosen their podcast to put on their in-flight entertainment system, and it doesn't belong to a big company. It's an independent.
No, it's really weird, this, isn't it? The show is called Celebrity Catch-Up, Life After That Thing I Did. And it's hosted by a person called Genevieve Hassan. It's a one-person thing, so no funding, no sponsorship, no revenue. But Virgin Atlantic heard it and they thought, well, this will be pretty good for the seat back in-flight entertainment thing. And that's where they've put it, which is great.
It is good news for those making tiny independent podcasts. But how much of a poke in the eye is it for the big companies?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Spotify, for example, has done deals with Delta in recent months, and I think JetBlue as well in the US to get podcasts onto their aeroplanes. And obviously, you know, if you're stuck in a tin can for quite some time, then you will start having a listen to stuff that you haven't actually heard yet. So it's probably, I would guess, a pretty exciting place to end up being. She says she's going to get some audience stats from Virgin as well. So it'll be interesting to find out how she does.
Let's talk about stats as well when we move to the United States. There's a Podcasting Today report to explore just how popular podcasts are now and who's listening to what.
Yes, this is from Nielsen, who put together a bunch of data around TV and radio and now podcasting in the US. They say that podcasting consumption went down during the start of the pandemic, but now it's higher than ever, although it's mostly being driven by people who don't listen to that many shows. So people that might listen to perhaps one show every month. So it does look as if more people are trying podcasting, but obviously for those of us in podcasting, we need to make sure that people are listening more and more.
And the stuff that they are listening to, it depends. Your demographic is incredibly important when it comes to this and where the money is.
Indeed, yes, absolutely. So people who listen to news, for example, are a bit older. They're an average age of 42 in the US. That's compared to comedy or true crime. Those have a younger audience of around 36. But then, of course, you've also got the income, which is the most important thing for advertisers. The average household income for a podcast listener is already quite high. It's $82,500 a year. But good news for this radio station, if you listen to news or business, then that income rises to $90,000 or even higher. Relatively good news if you're an advertiser.
Pretty bad news though, if you're wanting to make an arts podcast, because your listeners don't necessarily have such deep pockets.
No, maybe that's because they're spending money in the theatre, one would hope. But anyway, yes, they earn an average, according to Nielsen, of $71,000 in their household. Not quite sure why that is, but it might be interesting to have a look at in the future.
When reports like this from Nielsen come out, does this actually mark any kind of change in the number of and the kind of podcasts that are suddenly made? Does everybody suddenly want to make a news podcast because they know that their listeners are the ones with the money?
I think it has some of that effect, but I think also there's quite a lot of this data that comes out every single year. The real interest is actually with news. You have daily news shows, of course, and so therefore you have far more downloads than a weekly show. So there are opportunities there, and there are also clear opportunities in terms of shows which have a longer shelf life. A news podcast will probably be downloaded for a couple of weeks and will then go away again, because obviously nobody wants to have listened to last month's news.
Finally, James, the word podcast just sort of landed in our vernacular a few years ago. None of us really asked where it had come from, but now we've found out.
Well, yes, it was from a journalist at the time at The Guardian in the UK called Ben Hammersley, who came up with three different names for what you might call audio blogging all the way back in February of 2004. So this was part of a piece about early podcast history that we ran earlier on in the week from the UK.
And tell us a little bit more about then how it then developed, because it developed very quickly, didn't it?
It did, yeah. The first UK podcast that I can currently find, and I'm sure it's wrong, but nevertheless, it's the first one that I can find, is from a man called Vaughan Jackson. And it was a mix of music and talk. That's the first from the UK, of course. The BBC were pretty quick to follow. In November, they launched In Our Time, which is a history podcast. And Virgin Radio, which I was working for at the time, launched their daily podcast the next year. So that was interesting. The first advertising on a podcast was probably for Pepsi Max, or maybe for the UK government, one of those two, still trying to work out exactly who was first.
Slightly different products, I'd say. James Cridland, thank you so much for joining us here with The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally, the Swedish government is to propose an extra week's holiday for parents and guardians. The so-called family week will provide parents with up to 6 days' leave paid at 80% of their salary in order to spend time with their children. Charlie Duxbury is Politico's correspondent in Stockholm. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning, Emma.
So how's this going to work?
Well, the idea which was proposed in the budget which came this week is to, from next year, allow all parents of children between 4 and 16 to get an extra week paid by the government off work to do things like if your child is home for a holiday day, you can get paid by the state to be home with them.
And it works beautifully for families, but there has been an immediate pushback against this, hasn't there? Namely from a lot of small businesses.
That's right. The small businesses were, I mean, this idea was flagged quite a while back. So businesses have had a chance to kind of prepare their response. And it, as you might expect, it has been quite negative. They see this as another burden on their attempts to kind of survive, particularly in the pandemic and even in under normal circumstances, to kind of make their businesses work. They see this as one more expense that they're going to have to work around not having their employee in work.
You say that, you know, that this idea has been floated around for quite a while, but how much did the pandemic have an influence on deciding that actually parents and families can't work from home and they don't have the flexibility that perhaps others do?
Yeah, well, while this idea probably predates the pandemic, the pandemic and the way it has shown up the differences between those who are forced to kind of attend work and be in their workplaces versus those who have the flexibility to work from home. That divide has been highlighted by the pandemic and kind of brought forward in people's thinking and put, you know, arguably confirmed what the governing Social Democrats here already thought about the kind of unfairness potentially in their eyes of that divide.
We have Sweden as having quite a reputation here as being a real leader in progressive politics and social values. What is it that drives this and makes everybody look towards Stockholm?
Yeah, well, I would agree with that Sweden has been an innovator when it comes to social policy. The Social Democrats, who emerged around sort of 1930s, their sort of founding idea was to give workers more rights on the labour market. They began by kind of pushing for better conditions in workplaces. They then, over the decades, have moved on to, you know, more holiday for workers, shorter hours for workers, better, more strength towards workers when it comes to negotiating pay. So that's how it kind of got started. And then more recently, things like parental leave have become, Sweden has led there by giving parents more leave, dividing it equally between both parents, and also looking to shorten the working week. But that's been more kind of the left party have pushed an argument that a shorter working week would make people more productive. So there's quite a lot of innovative thinking going on.
It's innovative, but some might say that it is a very politically strong statement to prioritise the needs of the family over, let's say, a younger and child-free workforce. How problematic could this be ideologically?
Yeah, I think you're right that it is an ideological stance that the governing Social Democrats have taken. We've got an election here next year where all this will very much be to the fore. The Social Democrats' main opponents, the Moderate Party, which is a centre-right party, are seeing this as kind of a battle line being drawn. They would argue for kind of something like lower tax on income across the board. They would say that's fairer. While the Social Democrats say that the value to the family of having more time together and what that will build a stronger society in the long term outweighs that kind of arguable unfairness that their policy might entail.
Charlie Duxbury, thank you so much as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Louis Allen. After the headlines, more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday London time. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.